Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is Best Practice on RN Summer, where over the next month or so, we'll be revisiting some of the most interesting interviews, guests and stories from 2017. Later in the show, you'll hear how Alex, with some help from professional actors, prepares himself to negotiate a pay rise. Let's begin by meeting the man behind a truly remarkable philanthropic foundation.
Ready?
No, we'll jump.
Like hell we will.
No, it'll be okay. If the water's deep enough, we don't get squished to death. They'll never follow us.
How do you know?
Would you make a jump like that you didn't have to?
I have to, and I'm not gonna.
Well, we got to, otherwise we're dead.
Paul Newman and Robert Redford from one of my favourite films, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Paul Newman left us some great movies, but his legacy goes beyond that. His foundation, funded through the sale of salad dressing, pasta sauce and the like, has generated an astonishing amount of money. Almost $500 million has been dispersed to charities around the world, including here in Australia. Running the enterprise is Newman's friend, Bob Forrester. Bob's been involved in the not-for-profit sector for 47 years. So how did it all begin?
Well, not through a plan. I was a young Army officer. Actually, my first visit to Australia was on an R&R hearing from Vietnam. And when I went back to the States after my service, I went to work at a university, do my master's graduate work. And in order to support myself, I went to work in the university and ended up in their, what's called in America, their development office. And that's their fundraising department. Later became assistant to the president. And just over time, you know, 47 years later, I found that looking over my shoulder, that was my career, and it was a wonderful one.
Along the way, you've advised countless philanthropic organizations. Mm-hmm. What are, the challenges or difficulties they commonly face?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, there's so many. It's such a diverse field. Like in America alone, we have 1 million nonprofits just in America, and they're generally broken out between those who are seeking funds and those who are contributing funds. And certainly the search for money is the most common of all of the issues. Raising the voluntary dollar as opposed to selling a service for a fee to carry on the mission. So I think that becomes largely the biggest challenge. And then it depends on where they are in their life cycle. When nonprofits get started, they're typically started by somebody with great passion for the mission, the purpose. And if they begin to scale, they need to begin to change the way they operate. So we find that another common problem is with nonprofits or philanthropic organizations is that when they transition from the founder to a more mature organization, it's a very difficult transition.
That's what they have in common with private enterprise, isn't it?
Absolutely. Very much so.
I think that you are probably a couple of decades ahead of us in terms of professionalizing nonprofits. That's something that we've come to relatively recently in Australia. Mm-hmm. What are the things that absolutely have to be gotten right?
The thing that's very important is the maintaining a sense of integrity around the mission and the purpose of the organization. Because as you begin to professionalize, sometimes the business aspects of what you're doing can begin to overwhelm what your real purpose was in the beginning. And the business aspects are there to support that mission, but you have to have them. You have to have, for instance, in fundraising, which is one of the most critical areas, there needs to be a code of ethics. There needs to be a understanding of how to deal with and protect the privacy of donors, if you will, and how to be responsive in the use of funds. And these are sometimes difficult concepts for people to initially understand. You need to invest in your fundraising program. We find this very common outside of America where people say, well, if you're spending more than 1% or 2% on fundraising, that's not very good. We actually at Newman's Own have a little different take on that. If you're not spending enough, then you're not being a good enough steward of that money. Now, that doesn't mean extravagant spending, but enough so that you're protecting the investment of others going forward. So these are kinds of things that we learned over time and as we professionalized. And where it began to get professionalized first were in places like our great universities that have very, very significant business operations because they're, you know, some of them are billion-dollar
endowments.
Well, billion-dollar operations.
Yeah.
And so in terms of endowments, they're up over $20 billion if you look at Harvard or Yale or some places like that. So I think the idea of making sure that as you professionalize, you understand that you must have a business approach, but that business needs to be supportive of mission. And it's creating that partnership between two ways of thinking. Because if you come in and you try to be over business-like and you begin to force metrics that are not useful to what a nonprofit does, then you're distorting the mission.
There is a tension that has to be managed, isn't there?
I mean, tension is a great word.
You have to get things like governance and risk management right. Yeah. You have to get an income stream right. Yeah. But you're also not really there just to make money. You're there to do something.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And I love the word tension because we call it a constructive tension. A productive tension must exist. If it doesn't get, if it gets out of balance one way or the other, then we worry about that. When we're making grants, and we look at organizations, our purpose as a foundation is not to tell an organization how they should perform their mission. We think they're smarter than we are if they're dealing in the environment or children's issue with that issue, but we may be smarter than they are in terms of how to manage the relationship between the business function and the mission function.
Now, how unusual is the Newman Foundation? Because thinking about it from an outsider's perspective, it seems unusual in that you're in the commercial realm. You have products that people buy at supermarkets. So you're out there competing for consumer choice and you then use that money to disperse it. So you kind of have the full gamut, don't
right,
you?
We do. It's unusual to the extent that you can use our structure, you can use the word unique in terms of how we're structured today with a actual foundation. We are a grant-making foundation, and we own 100% of Newman's Own, the food company, 100% of our licensing company. That's unique. There's no other thing like it. Now, during Paul's lifetime, there was not a foundation. He owned it all. Everything went to him, and he personally gave it away. When he started that in 1982, again, it was unique. Today, we've identified over 25, and I'm sure we're underestimating that number significantly, other companies now in America who are modeled after Newman's Own. We had a little study done. There's a great demand to do more of it. Why we're unique is that what you can do in your lifetime, there's not much in the way of alternative after passing. So these other companies, the founders and owners are still very much alive. So I'm actually working in Washington now with our Congress to try to get special legislation that recognizes the value of this, we call a philanthropic enterprise. And it's always an interesting thing, if I can continue a bit, that managing the business side and the philanthropy side, at the end of the day, the philanthropic side must be the dominant decision maker. It's a very interesting balance. Mostly it's in line, but there may be times when the company might say, well, you know, we can make some really good money here. But from the philanthropic point of view, we'll say, no, we don't really feel comfortable about what you're thinking about. Even though it's perfectly legitimate, it may not just fit into our value proposition as a company. I can't tell you exactly what that might mean, but that's something that's very, very important. We are a philanthropy.
So it's been going now altogether. He started it in 82.
Right.
Here we are, what, 35 years later. Yeah. The foundation's dispersed almost $500 million.
We'll hit that mark this summer, yeah. American summer, yeah. That is.
To charities around the world, including here. That's a lot of salad dressing, isn't it?
That's exactly what Paul would say.
So that's where the money predominantly still comes from.
Well, salad dressing, yeah, that's our large. We have over 324 products now. Salad dressing is still our major line, but pasta sauce is close to it. And so, but salad dressing is, yeah, that's our mother, if you will, and it's still there. It's what we sell here in Australia. And yeah, it's an amazing enterprise.
How tricky was it after Paul Newman died in 2008? Because as you say, you've gone from the founder to, I suppose, life beyond the founder. That's a difficult transition, yeah. Whether you're in private enterprise, whether it's a sporting context, or in the nonprofit world.
It is. Paul was a very close friend of mine, and I had actually encouraged Paul in his lifetime to get the foundation started so that he could see how it was would operate and could change it, could change the people, which he couldn't do once he was gone. So we had the opportunity to actually work with Paul for close to 4 years in a partnership. He, when we started the foundation, he asked me to be the president of it, but he remained the chairman. When Paul started the company in 1982, one of the questions he was asked, actually on a radio show, is, well, can a company that gives all its money away survive? And Paul said, well, who knows? It hasn't been tried before. Big question that I was asked was, can Newman's Own survive without Paul Newman? And again, the answer is, who knows, but we're determined to make it happen. I had feel that I have two roles. One, as I said to Paul, if you die before me and I have to do this, you come back in the room 10 years later, you may not know the people or what we're talking about, but you'll approve of how it feels. So implicit in that are two promises. One, that the business is still going and strong, otherwise we won't be here. And number two, that the values and the culture are still there. And that was very important to me, is to make sure that how the company feels, how it thinks about itself, people remain the same. Paul never put anything in any documents that said we had to do things in a certain way. So I'm kind of, even though I have all these titles, I'm more of a steward of that legacy.
One of the things I am keen to kind of unpack is, how do you decide? I mean, you must get many more worthy applicants than you can possibly disperse. So what are the criteria? What's the process?
First of all, we don't have an open application process. We do it all through invitation. But we have people all around the world who can invite people to or get a hold of us. So while it's not open that we just get a rush of applications, so it's very important to us that people we know are kind of the first line of referral because they're in their communities. We have four major areas that we look into. They're very broad. They're more like windows. The first is just encouraging philanthropy and as broadly as possible. The next would be children with life-limiting conditions. In the developed world, it tends to be children with medical conditions, but if we're in the developing world, it could be children in slavery. There's victims of war, all sorts of other things. Nutrition. And then the final one is empowerment. And empowerment's not a political statement. It really goes to the core of what was kind of Paul's thinking, that, you know, he was lucky in life. Other people aren't lucky. There are barriers that were barriers of circumstance between them and their potential, whether it could be a physical disability or born in poverty. And so our job there is to help lower those barriers, and it's up to the people to find where they're going to go with those.
Bob, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Bob Forrester, President and CEO of Newman's Own Foundation. On RN Summer Online or wherever you get your podcast, this is Best Practice. I'm Richard Adie. Do you wish you were better at asserting yourself at work? You come to the right place. Earlier this year, we looked at how corporate actors play out scenarios to help people skill up. One of the companies that does this is NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art in Sydney. Reporter Anne Arnold was allowed to sit in when a small group of employees from various workplaces came along for a one-day course in persuasive negotiation. And one of the participants agreed to be recorded.
Basically, I've been given extra roles and responsibilities, and I want a way to not say no, but I want that to be acknowledged with salary and contract negotiations and things like that.
Meet Alex, who has a problem at work. At least Alex is what we're calling him. His employer doesn't know that he's doing this course in persuasive negotiation.
In the past, I've been a bit of a yes man, so I want to be able to assert myself.
Are you concerned that you've been too agreeable?
Definitely. Yeah, as soon as I feel that someone is pushing against me, I tend to retract and just agree with them, or I feel embarrassed.
Alex would be far from alone in struggling with this, especially in a workplace setting.
Oh, as soon as it starts to feel the tension, I feel like I just want to try and break that and go back to, you know, a nice amicable conversation as friends rather than, you know, this boss employee sort of thing. Yeah.
So that's Alex's dilemma that he's brought to this part of a day-long course. To help solve it, the course leaders will take the Russian theatre practitioner Stanislavski's notion of given circumstances and apply it to workplace communication scenarios.
Oh, and it's always in a meeting room, like it's a glass meeting room, which is really weird because it's like everyone can see in as well.
Alex first briefs actor Gus Murray on the setting for his real-life quest. Gus will play his boss.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
It's so like it's in the middle of my office.
Space.
No, it's in the middle of our office, like basically in the centre of it. There's two parts and in the centre is a glass meeting room.
Right.
So like everyone walks past like, oh, what are you doing?
Right,
like
I see.
Like, I think it's on purpose. 100% it is. 100% it is.
Yeah, you can't cry and stand.
Can't like stand up and walk out, that sort of thing. Yeah, I know everything about it is designed to give them power, like, you know, the two people there on me and like all that sort of stuff. But yeah.
Another course participant, Linda, sits in as the other manager who Alex would expect to see at a meeting to discuss his pay.
How are you?
How are you?
Good to see you.
Excellent
guys.
To see you.
You too, you too. Hi, Linda, how are you?
Grab a seat. Do you
thank
need
you.
A glass of water or anything?
Mate, I'm fine. It's all good.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Look, I'm sorry we had to break the meeting in half. We've obviously been through your performance review and the direction that we're headed, but lunch popped in the middle of that.
No, that's fine.
So let's continue on to probably the part that you're most interested in.
Yes.
Which is salary and where we're going for there. So as you know, we've been really happy with your performance. I want you to know how much we value you, and we try to find ways that we can show you how much we value you throughout the year, not necessarily always with money, but with other perks and events and things that, that show you how much we value. In terms of your salary for the coming year, we've got here, I've just printed out what we're able to do and what's been approved by the board, and it's a raise of that much, of 2.5%,
okay,
which I think, as you would know, is above the inflation levels at the moment, is also in keeping with the raises that are being handed out, certainly across the board here. And generally, we are a company that is a benchmark company for reimbursement of our employees.
Sure.
And so you would find that that's extremely competitive within the market.
Sure. Is that the best number that you can offer me?
It is. We've thought long and hard about it. We've had meetings.
Sure.
We've spoken to the board. And
sure,
this is what's been affirmed by the board.
And that's the best number that you can offer me today?
Yes. That's been decided.
As you know, I've been at the company for nearly 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Every single year, I've basically been at the top of my field every year. And every year, I've agreed to, you know, I think undervalued salary raises. So I think, you know, for this year, to look back and to see all the work that I've done, the loyalty that I've shown, the response I've gotten from our clients has been top rate.
Okay.
You can't disagree with that.
No. I'm aware of that.
Mm.
And I'm aware of the raises you've had in the past. I mean, you haven't voiced vociferously any disagreement with what we've done in the past.
Know,
and I can say some years we have been quite generous,
point.
More than generous, I would say, in terms
of
raises.
I think for the industry we're in, and I think the growth that our company has shown, clearly there's money in the company for raises. You wouldn't have to disagree with that, would you?
Well, look,
Let's pause there. Well done. All right, let's hold it there. Good. Well done. Oh, nice work. Good job.
This is trainer Sean Hall, who's also an actor. He's running the course.
How's it feeling up there?
It's a bit stressful. Yeah,
it's a bit stressful.
Yeah. I thought it was I know you wrote like quite a low number, so it's sort of. Yeah, it gave me the shits. Like I was sort of like, you know, I think I felt a bit insulted by the number.
Okay.
And it sort of felt like you weren't valuing me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But the response that Alex tried might not get him the raise he's after. Sean Hall has mixed feedback.
Let's look at some of the things we might just want to work on just slightly. So I think from the beginning, like we talked about at the get-go of the day, I feel like you can take greater presence in the room physically by looking at lengthening the spine and increasing breadth through the chest, just to give that physical kind of indication that you're someone that has presence and a leadership presence inside the room.
Mm-hmm.
How was your breathing? Remember we talked a lot about breathing this morning.
Yeah, I felt pretty short breath.
Short of breath.
I felt like my heart rate raising and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
And I can notice that it's not overt. It's not very explicit that you're quite nervous, but I can kind of hear it in the voice a little bit. Now, I reckon, yes, you did interrupt Gus, but Gus was doing a pretty good job at not letting you talk, I think.
Yeah.
I think he was pretty clear at like, okay, this is what we've got.
Yeah.
So if you are going to interrupt him, let's think about rather than maybe the choice of like, is this the best that you can do, which is seems like a quite a confrontational opener. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can, before Gus puts that piece of paper in front of you, let's see if you can start a conversation with Gus mm-hmm. and get him to see the value of your work. Mm-hmm. At
so like when he's talking about, you know, you've had a good year and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, guys, grab onto it. Yes, like actively listening. So yeah, it's been terrific this year, you know, from the work that we did on this particular job and this one, it was great. We got that great feedback from the client. And
yeah.
Just see if you can start building a case for the fact that you're worth more than 2.5% increase this year. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
Gus, did you have any feedback from what we've said so far?
Yeah, I think that you've got a very naturally good style of communication. Your voice is very good. I think breathing and that type of thing will help. Just starting with a positive case, if you go into the meeting with like 1, 2, 3 points of why you deserve this that you might be able to pull out at any time, mm-hmm. as opposed to I did find some of the questioning you were doing getting, you weren't aggressive at all, but you were confrontational, and it might not be the best way to start your negotiation mm-hmm. in terms of you saying, I know there's a lot of money in this company. This company makes a lot of money. You can afford to do some to raises. Again, quite confrontational, which you might get to.
So how would you start elsewhere? What would you suggest starting up elsewhere? Like, would it be, you know, I've done a great job this year?
Yeah, I would start more with positive things about yourself.
So a few things for Alex to work on.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Sounds good?
Yeah, sure.
All right, good. So let's find that length right from the get-go, yeah? So remember we did that thing before, we've stood up, found balance through our feet, arms up, opening, big stretch, opening up the chest, good, ready to go?
Yeah, sure.
Keeping it positive, big smile on your face, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a positive thing.
Cool.
Okay, let's go for it.
Alex has another attempt, but he has difficulty interrupting his manager and asks him what he thinks about Alex's work rather than putting his own case. So here goes Alex for third time lucky.
I was coming in here, you know, I think I've had quite a good year, as you were mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as you know, you've seen the numbers. I think I was about 10% above my nearest similar employee.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, you know, I think as myself as an individual, I think I've really contributed to the business. So, I mean, you know, it's a really good number. But if it's possible, maybe could I see an increase in that number at all?
Thanks for your feedback.
Mm.
The difficulty is that this has been approved by the board.
Sure, I understand.
It's larger than just you. It's an across-the-board kind of range that we're working mm-hmm. within. And this, at the moment, is what the board has approved.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, you know, I understand that the board has their decisions and everything like that. But, you know, if there's any way that we could come back at a later date and maybe look at, you know, in 2 months or 3 months, maybe renegotiating the terms or something like that.
Look, that's certainly potential. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know that we've always looked after you in the past.
We
did the bonus system last year. And
it's been really good,
and,
you know. I think as my role's progressed, and as you know, I've been training lots of others during the year. So obviously you see the value and the knowledge and the expertise that I have. So I think, you know, if you could see a way to compensate me for those extra skills that I've got over my colleagues, I think that would, you know, it would help me to feel better about the situation. I'm not asking for a great deal, but I just think the number that you've sort of given me here is maybe a little bit low.
Right.
Okay. Let's just pause it there. Let's pause it there. Okay. How's that feeling this time around?
Yeah, better.
It is better.
Yeah.
There's lots of really positive things that you're doing there. It seems like there's a real give and take between you and the person that you're speaking with. Mm-hmm. There's an element of you conceding without having to butt in and get quite adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the value of what you bring to the organization.
Yep.
There are elements that I feel like you could sharpen and refine to a certain extent, but if this is the farthest that you've gone in a negotiation over pay
mm-hmm.
in this particular situation, I think this has been a really valuable kind of
process
for you to go through because
it was
better.
That was fantastic.
Oh, thanks, man.
It was really good. Really good.
Cool. Very reasonable.
Well done. Good job.
Let's
give him a big round of applause. Good job. All right.
So Alex nails it. A big thanks to NIDA Corporate for allowing us to record and share their teaching. Also to Alex for bravely being the guinea pig and actor facilitators Sean Hall and Gus Murray. And thank you as well to reporter Anne Arnold. And that's the show.
Best Practice here on RN Summers, produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is Amrita Betancourt. I'm Richard Adie. Have a good Christmas.